Welcome to the Studying the Bible podcast, where every Thursday, Pastors Dylan Dodson and Brian Androsian study a book of the Bible, verse by verse, to see what is being communicated and how we can use it to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We pray that today's podcast can help you grow just a little bit closer to Christ.
Welcome back to our online Bible study through the book of Esther. And this session will be in Esther chapter 2, verse 19, through Esther chapter 3, verse 15. Now, where we just left off is that Esther has just become queen. She is chosen out of all of the women in the kingdom who came and were essentially tested by Herod, or sorry, by Xerxes, to see who he would want to choose to replace Vashti. She becomes queen, and here's what happens next, verse 19. When the virgins were gathered a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not revealed her family background or her ethnicity, as Mordecai had directed. She obeyed Mordecai's orders, as she always had while he raised her. So remember, Mordecai has adopted Esther and raised her, and he was the one who's trying to help her and now make sure that she is okay now that she is queen of Persia. Now, sometime, here's just the context of this, sometime after becomes queen, the story picks up again. We're not told the distance here or the time frame here between verse 18 and verse 19. Now, here it says that Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, which shows that he had some sort of official position, because to sit at the gate in ancient world means you were discussing things like politics or making judgments, where things of importance were discussed. And so Esther, again, has kept her Jewish identity hidden following Mordecai's advice. Again, we're continuing the difficulty of Esther of why they make certain decisions the way that they do. I mean, certain Jews, if you're an ancient Jew and you're reading this story up until this point, you would be maybe get kind of frustrated that you're hiding your identity. Of course, they're maybe afraid for their life. And so she has not revealed that she also is a Jew out of Mordecai's advice. And then verse 21. During those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the entrance, became infuriated and planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. When Mordecai learned of the plot, he reported it to Queen Esther, and she told the king on Mordecai's behalf. So again, Mordecai probably knows a lot of the business affairs of the kingdom because he is one of the officials in the king's court, or at least near the king's gate. And so he hears of this assassination plot by two of the king's units or two of the king's guards, you know, his trusted people to keep him safe. And so he tells the queen, who then tells the king, and she probably most likely, yeah, tells the king on Mordecai's behalf, gives him credit, like tells the king that Mordecai is the one who has found out this assassination attempt was going down. So this is a big deal that he not only finds out about it, but then shares it so that nothing would happen to the king. And then verse 23, it says this, when the report was investigated and verified, both men were hanged on the gallows. This event was recorded in the historical record in the king's presence. In the king's presence. Now, as we read this, we have to wonder that here it does not say anything happens to Mordecai, who in that ancient culture, if you were to save particularly the king from assassination, it is assumed that you would be handsomely rewarded for what you have done, and yet nothing happens here. Right, nothing happens here. It's important to note, again, also that this event was recorded because later on in Esther, we'll see that King Xerxes is reading over these events and realizes that nothing has been done for Mordecai. But up until this point, Mordecai was not immediately rewarded, which again would have been the custom. And so it's just, again, it's fair for us to ask this. At the end of this session, we'll give a few reflections on this passage. But at least for now, how do you and I respond to unfair circumstances? Like, what do we do when we have clearly done something good or maybe noble or maybe God-honoring, and we're not rewarded the way that we think we are deserved to be or should happen? Because that's what happens here. Although Mordecai and Esther, again, are Jews who have clearly assimilated into Persian culture, he did do a right thing. You would be, again, as an ancient person reading this, you would wonder why nothing happened to him, why he wasn't recorded or rewarded. We're not told why he wasn't rewarded. But then it says this in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, after all this took place, King Ahasuerus honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. He promoted him in rank and gave him a higher position than all the other officials. So again, we aren't told what the timeline here, we aren't told exactly when it happens, but it seems to be that roughly about 5 years after Esther becomes queen, that is when the assassination attempt fails. We see because in chapter two and later times when certain things happen, you can kind of piece the chronology of events together. So she's been queen about 5 years when this assassination attempt doesn't take place. Again, we're not told exactly why, but after all of this, Mordecai isn't rewarded or promoted or anything, but yet this guy named Haman, which in Hebrew sounds like the name or is similar to the word Hameh, which means wrath, which again the ancient Jews would have picked up on this. This guy who is an Agagite, which we'll talk about the significance in a second, whose name is similar, likely would have brought this idea of wrath into your mind, was promoted to the highest official in the kingdom. Mordecai does a good thing. Haman, we're not told, does anything, yet he gets promoted. And more importantly, he's also an Agagite. And here's why this matters. I'm going to give you a brief history of why this is such a big deal and such a red flag to ancient Jews who would read this story. So it starts with the Amalekites, also known as the Agagites. I'll explain why in a second how they mean the same thing. But the Amalekites were the first people to attack Israel in the wilderness after God rescues Israel out of Egypt, and they're on their way to the promised land. The Amalekites come and try to attack Israel. If you're familiar with the story where Moses has to hold the staff over his head for them to win the battle, this is the one that is happening or one that's referring to. And so they attack unprompted, the Amalekites attack the Israelites to try to wipe them out. Now, because of this attack, God promised Moses that he would completely erase the memory of the Amalekites once the Israelites got into the promised land. Why? There's a lot of reasons for this. The main one I just want to touch on here is because to try to wipe out the people of God, Israel, would therefore be a threat to God's promise to Abraham that all of the nations would be blessed through him. In a sense, it would be an attempt to stop the Messiah from coming. Now, of course, we know God is God and he's in control of all things. But this is what it essentially does. An attack on God's people, the Israelites, to completely wipe them out would make it so that Messiah, God's blessing promised to Abraham that all the nations would be blessed through him, would not happen. And so God commanded Israel, once they were settled into land, to blot out the Amalekites forever. Now, Agag, here's important to know, was the king of the Amalekites at the time of Saul. So when Israel anoints their first king, King Saul, Agag is the king of the Amalekites. Also, we're pointing out that Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin, which is the same tribe that Mordecai is from. He's the first king of Israel. He gets anointed king in 1 Samuel 15. And then God commands Saul to attack the Amalekites, which he does, but he doesn't do what God says. After this attack, he actually takes Agag the king and keeps him alive, as well as some of his choice splendor and cattle and wealth. He's not faithful, right? He partially does what God asks, but he doesn't all do what God asks. He spares Agag and he allows him to live the rest of his life. And again, by association, he also clearly spares some of the Amalekites or the Agagites. And so what happens here is that because Saul did not do what God said he was supposed to do, commanded him to do, all these years later, when the Israelites are in exile, you have an Agagite who rises to power, and you have the Mordecai the Jew who gets nothing for what he did. So this is a big tension there again. Mordecai not rewarded. This man named Haman, who is a mortal enemy of the Jewish people as an Agagite throughout their history with the Jews and the Amalekites, is now promoted. This is not good. Then it says this in verse 2 of chapter 3 as you keep reading. The entire royal staff at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman because the king had commanded this to be done for him. But Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage. The members of the royal staff at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why are you disobeying the king's command?" When they had warned him day after day, and he would still not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see if Mordecai's actions would be tolerated, since he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying homage, he was filled with rage. So again, we aren't told why Mordecai doesn't bow. Was it for religious reasons, right? He's clearly, again, as we've seen previously, that he has Mordecai has assimilated a lot into the culture, but he's still a Jew, and he still knows the history between the Jews and the Agagites, and so maybe it was for religious reasons that he wouldn't bow down to an Agagite. Maybe it was for just simply political reasons. They didn't think it was fair. Again, maybe it wasn't so much that Mordecai was a practicing Jew, other than just the fact that they know that the Agagites have always been an enemy of his people, and so he's not going to bow down to him. Again, wasn't told. Was it because maybe Haman was an Agagite, and again, simply the Jews didn't like him? Like, again, we don't know, but for whatever the reason is, Mordecai will not bow down to Haman. Also, I think it's worth pointing out that Haman doesn't notice he doesn't bow down until this is pointing out, right? And again, because his Jewishness is mentioned, it likely does seem that there are some maybe religious reasons for this. So again, you have all these people who are bowing down. Haman doesn't notice until it was told. And then he's also told that he's a Jew. So people probably knew of the history of the Jews and the Agagites in some way, because this prompts Haman to get really upset, or as it says, is filled with rage. So here's how he responds, verse 6 of chapter 3. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, it seemed repugnant to Haman to do away with Mordecai alone. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews throughout Ahasuerus' kingdom. Now, finally here in verse 6 of chapter 3, the plot of this book, of the book of Esther, is revealed. Right? Again, if you had no background of this story, now you would begin to see why Esther might have been brought into power. Right, you begin to see that although God's name is not mentioned, he clearly has been involved the whole time, because now the story is really going to begin. And of course, again, look at the threat here. He wants to wipe out all of the Jewish people, just like the Amalekites did when the Israelites were freed from Egypt. And so we get to think, wow, what is God doing here? Why is Esther queen? It might be because he's going to use her or use them in some way, but we don't know what's going to happen. So here, let's see what happens next. Chapter 3, verse 7. In the first month, the month of Nisan, in King Ahasuerus' 12th year, the pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman for each day in each month, and it fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. So again, here's how we can find some of these timelines in the book of Esther. The 12th year was 5 years after Esther had become queen. The pur was cast by Haman to see when the Jews would be destroyed. The pur is essentially like a pagan astrology or magician type thing where you would essentially consult the gods. Like, what do the gods want me to do here? I'm going to cast the pur and see how they decide. You can maybe, I mean, it's not the same thing as rolling the dice or casting lots, but it's that sort of thing. You're just kind of letting fate, if you will, decide what you are supposed to do or when you are going to destroy the Jews. And so here's what it says next in verse 8. Then Haman informed King Ahasuerus, "There is one ethnic group scattered throughout the peoples in every province of your kingdom, keeping themselves separate. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If the king approves, let an order be drawn up authorizing their destruction, and I will pay 375 tons of silver to the officials for deposit in the royal treasury." So again, this is when Haman, not decides to destroy the Jews, but goes before the king to tell him about what is happening. And so again, here's what this seems to point out. While the Jews were scattered throughout the empire, living in exile, Haman clearly here is no doubt exaggerating their number and their influence. And so again, while the Jews had assimilated into Persian culture, there still seemed to be enough of a distinction with the Jews and their practices and their laws and their customs that they were viewed as different. But they still obeyed the kingdom. They didn't necessarily break the kingdom laws, even if they had some of their own customs and traditions. And so Haman wants the king to agree to this assassination or to this genocide. And so again, no doubt that he exaggerates the amount of money that he could take from them. Again, the thought here is if you kill and wipe them out, you're going to be able to take all of their possessions, which might have been somewhat substantial. It's doubtful that it was this substantial. But again, he wants the king to decide or to side with his plan. He wants to set the Jews up as these terrible people who do not obey the king or the kingdom. So here's what happens next, verse 10. The king removed his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jewish people. Then the king told Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with it, to do with as you see fit." So the king here gives his signet ring to Haman, meaning he had absolute authority to do whatever he wished, that whatever Haman says, it's just like the king has authorized it himself. Now, to point out here, to be fair, the king obviously is no doubt an evil man. I mean, just the process of finding another queen, as we saw last session, was awful. But in this instance, he seems to be the passive party. Now, we would say this. Well, of course, it's worse to be the leading charge of evil, but passive compliance to evil is still evil. I mean, maybe a cliche, but a well-known example is Nazi Germany, right? The leaders of the Nazi party are clearly held responsible and looked at discussed for what they have done. But even the people, all the people that went along with it, with persecuting the Jews and telling on them and rounding them up and helping, making sure they go to concentration camps and all of these evil things, while they're not leading the charge, they're still complicit and it's still evil. Although this is not King Ahasuerus's or King Xerxes' idea, he's still letting it happen, which is still, of course, extremely wrong. So here's what happens next, verse 12. It says, "The royal scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and the order was written exactly as Haman commanded. It was intended for the royal satraps, the governors of each of the provinces, and the officials of each ethnic group, and written for each province in its own script, and to each ethnic group in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the royal signet ring." Now here, what we see is that the date of the genocide is hugely significant, maybe not for you and for me, but for ancient Jews. Because the day of this genocide that it was signed was actually signed on the eve of Passover. So again, you get these imageries and these retellings of Israel and Egypt, right? The Passover was, again, what's the celebration of God's delivering his people from Egypt. And now they're about to be told on the eve of Passover that you're all going to die. And so they send out this decree to all the people groups, all the ethnicities, all the languages in the kingdom. It's signed with the royal signet ring so that when people read it, when the community leaders read it in their various communities, they would have known that this is legitimate and this is real and this is from the king himself. Now, again, as a Jew, you hear this, you're terrified, and it's happening the day before you're supposed to celebrate God's deliverance. Now I feel like God's abandoned you. And then here's how the passage that we're reading today ends, verse 13 through 15. It says, "Letters were sent by couriers to each of the royal provinces, telling the officials to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jewish people, young and old, women and children, and plunder their possessions on a single day, the 13th day of Adar, the 12th month. A copy of the text issued as law throughout every province was distributed to all the people so that they might get ready for that day. The couriers left, spurred on by royal command, and the law was issued in the fortress of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink while the city of Susa was in confusion." So this edict is sent out, and of course, we know through human history, as scripture says, people are sheep. We are herd animals, it seems, and how we act and how we interact, and as much as we like to assume that we'll always make the right decision, it's really hard to go against peer pressure. Of course, in this situation, it's hard to go against greed, knowing that you can, for free, take out some of these neighbors and get what they have, especially in a culture where there's not banks necessarily for the common people. You don't have a lot of savings. I mean, anything that you can have to help you get ahead is a big deal. So this edict is sent out, but people, it says, are confused, perhaps because, I mean, that seems like a really incredible thing to do, to invite not just maybe the military leaders, but all people to join in on this assassination or this genocide. But they also could be fearful that if it could happen to the Jews, that it could happen to the non-Jews as well. Because remember, Persia is the largest kingdom in the human history at this time. They have a lot of different ethnic groups and people groups in their kingdom. And so if they see one specific people group or ethnicity is being called out to be killed, they also could think, well, what if it happens to us and to our people? And so people are confused. Now, the question for us is, what are we to do with this? Right? What are we to do with this passage here? It ends not on a high note. As we read it, maybe there's not a lot of things that we can personally take and apply to ourselves if you read this passage in isolation. So what are we to do? Well, a couple of things to take away, especially as you end this passage on a low note. Here's the things I want to point out. Three things from the passage we read. Number one is this, that our level of trust in God determines our response to unfair treatment. Now, the text isn't necessarily saying that Mordecai did this when he wasn't rewarded. But again, if you think about it in your own life, when things don't happen, when things seem unfair, we are much more likely to get upset and angry or even maybe want to plot some sort of revenge if we don't get what we think we deserve. And so our level of trust in God determines our response to unfair treatment, however it happens, because if we trust that God cares, that he's in control, that he is over all things, of course it doesn't mean that we'll get what we want. It doesn't mean that things won't be unfair in the moment, but we know that God loves us, and of course in his kingdoms, all wrongs will be made right. If we actually trust God and his goodness, even when it's hard, it will change our response to unfair treatment. It doesn't mean we still won't like it. It doesn't mean it still won't be hard, but perhaps we'll have more peace. It won't affect us as much, and it will maybe keep us from making some poor decisions. And so we have to trust God when things don't go the way we want. That's something that comes to mind as I read this passage. Second thing is this, that our hope does not come only from God's goodness, but also from his power. So if God is good and loving, which we believe he is, but he is not powerful, then it doesn't really matter in some sense how good and loving somebody is if they can't execute that love and that goodness and make sure it happens, right? Like if you have kids, you might love your kids, your kids might love you, but if someone robs your house, your kid isn't going to be able to stop them. And so this is the same thing for us, that God is not only good, but he's also powerful. Again, we're already getting hints here that the Jews are supposed to be wiped out through genocide, and yet God has placed Esther, a Jew, as queen over all of Persia. Now, of course, the king, Haman, doesn't know, or Haman does not know this yet, but you might assume that God might be up to something. And so our hope, again, the good news for us is that God is not just good and loving, but he's powerful, and he's over all things, which means we can trust him even when things are difficult. And lastly, I would point out this, that God's providence is greater than life's injustices. Now, life can be really unjust and really unfair, and people can go a long time, maybe all of their life, being treated unfairly. But God's providence, his control over all things, is greater than that. Maybe in this life, we might see some of that, but certainly in life to come, when Jesus returns and inaugurates his kingdom, he will overcome all evil, all wrong, all pain, all suffering. Well, I believe in some sense make a lot more sense then than it does now. That God is over injustice and can even use injustice, as we'll see throughout this book, for his own means. And so we have to trust God. We know that he's powerful. We know that we can trust him when life is hard and difficult, and that he is over even the wrong things. That when people think, when we make plans, that here's what we're going to do, as James, the book of James tells us in the New Testament, we actually have no idea that God, not us, is in the one that's in control of all things, which is good news. And it's what we're going to see as we continue through the book of Esther.